less arbitrary than the gods we already came up with.
Well, some people think about unification, and since there is no one form of God or one understanding of God, if there is a God, for some there is not, from some there is, then maybe it is just a human way of reaction. Putin cannot have everything, but can destroy it. So if you have something and they don't have it, instead of trying to achieve it, they just destroy it. You don't have it. They don't have it. This is the craziness of communism. It's not that I'm trying to be negative to the Russian, I do respect nation, but it is what it is. So somebody implemented AI, in AI, a typical human behavior. You don't have it, because I don't have it. You don't want to give it out, I destroy you. And I destroy that particle thing. That's what communism was about. Back to you.
Okay, I have more complex thoughts about. I don't think anything lately going on is communist. I think Russian is fascist. You know, they have a heavy religious, moralistic bent. You know, they're acting just like Germany did right before the war. So I don't think there's any hint of communism in Mother Russia anymore. And I don't think particularly China is communist, really. They have capitalism. It's somewhat anarcho-capitalism. It's cronyism. It's a bunch of cheating guys who got into the Communist Party who get their piece of the action. You know, they're running a mob just as the same way that Vlad is running a mob. So I don't think any of this is inherently, economically speaking, communism. This is just a greedy bunch of bastards just trying to steal everything that isn't screwed down. So, but, you know, you're free to have your thoughts.
Somebody was trying to respond. I was talking about the universal solution. In other words, it's like unifying something. The system in Russia is, for me, in my personal opinion, is a fascist system right now. And a similar one is in China. It's like for the benefit of dictator. I'm not trying to right now talk about. forget about it. I'm not gonna go there. No. Okay. Unifying something up to the point of one solution, of one universal solution. One universal solution is, I don't have it. You have it. I make you not have it. And that's what AI was eventually programmed. By people who look for universal solutions and to exist, and somebody was trying to respond.
Comment?
Yes, please.
Do you know why Russians hate capitalism?
Russians don't hate capitalism. Russians are capitalists. It's cronyism. It basically, they stole all the resources of their country, and then they took the money and invested it all over the world. They're the biggest capitalists there are.
It's kind of a joke. I was going to say the reason why Russians hate capitalism is because they always write in small letters.
Okay.
That was funny.
Okay. It's an individual, personal type of thing.
Thanks.
not going to take too much time on it, so the next one is easy. Yes, FTX one speaker issue, I wrote to Paul. Paul is the CW guy. I'm not sure about the Dr. Roy, but both of you got, I've got email, and Paul wrote me back. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am. Yeah, which one are you talking about? WS1.
Yeah, FTX one speaker issue for CW.
I did not get a chance to look at that. I looked at the story about the printing of the rocket. That one I saw.
No, you wrote me that the CW problem is another good reason to keep away from Yesu. I hope Yesu fixes this issue. Paul, WS2M. So I thought you could have some comment on it back to you.
Okay, yeah, I did. Yeah, wasn't that last week? I thought that was last week. Yeah, you might have sent it early in the week, and then I sent a return to you. That's probably what it was. I remember now. Yeah, that was a video showing that there was apparently a glitch in the rig, the Yesu rig. It's a rig that uses primarily on QRP, but then they have the capability to hook it up to a 100-watt amplifier as well to operate at the base station. But the guy ran a test, and he had a bunch of different keys attached to it, and he tried the different ones. And with the one particular setting that he was using, it was almost getting like an echo of a different sound off the keys, a delayed noise. It would be okay maybe for slow CW, but not fast CW. Said, yeah, that's why I wrote back. Yeah, they're going to have to fix that. I forget the name of the rig, the model number, but yeah, you know which one. I'm sure you have it right there. Back to us, WS2.
And to extreme. Yeah, the, Dr. Roy, do you have a comment on it?
No, not really.
So then I decided that I'm going to create a point with some soil points on it, and that would be dedicated to PLF transceivers. And then we have a number of choices for VLF. But actually, I'm a VLF guy. That's what interests me. So we have a KN990HF. Now, the reason I decided to go for it is because this transceiver is advertised as 0 to 130 megahertz. And this is BCW, AM, FM, digital, IF, DSP, amateur, whatever, receiver. And it looks nice. It has a water flow, nice display, and whatsoever. Now, this one costs. So KN990HF, 0.1 to 30 megahertz, and it's $669, of course, it's China. It looks nice, though, but that's one of the choices that we have. And we have quite few choices. The next one would be Flex 1500 for 630 meters and 2,200 meters. And that one is for Roy. I especially mentioned that in the email, that is for Roy to comment. So you have a two lower band that could be used by ham radio amateurs. And Dr. Wu, your comment?
Yeah, I mean, it depends upon the design of these radios. I think I mentioned my 6700 wasn't really meant to be used as a 2 meter transceiver. It had a low signal output. It had a low signal input. If you stuck some high gain, low noise amplifiers on both ends, you could use it to talk on repeaters, which is what I did. It took a couple hundred extra bucks of money to plug it into those ports, but it depends upon the design. A lot of times engineers will kind of leave a low signal port with the option of the owner to increase his investment and spend more money to amplify it. So it's all good if you like to play with those things. The 1500, I think, was the Flex 1500 was sort of known for that. It was a low-cost device. I haven't seen anyone really talk about any other version of the Flex radios, although it wouldn't surprise me that it had some access, that if you put the proper high-gain, low-noise amplification circuits on it, that it could work other frequencies.
Yeah, one of the comments that I found is I have a Flex 1500 for years, 630 meters and 2200 meters. It puts a nominal 1 milliwatt on the transmitter port and whatsoever. So it's like the solution out of the box. And the next one was QRP Labs. It's a QDX-M transceiver. And it's only 65 dots. But assembled is $110, so you don't have to do anything, and it does it too. And I have a configuration for it. And then the next one would be the VLF at 8 kHz. 8 kHz is especially interesting to me, and there is a video. The video is VLF experiments on 8 kHz again, where you repeat the title VLF. Experiments on 8 kHz, and is by amateurs in Canada. One of them says a little about himself, and he says about him having a certificate of proficiency, and then he is a manager of RAC section in Newfoundland and Labrador, and Coral Sanctuary Wireless Association, whatever. And then we have some records in January 15, 2021. Alan Griffin, added with International News and Futures, ham radio operator. He made a VO01NA. He made a contact. There was Stefan Scheffner, DK7FC. Both of them, they had a contact on 8 kHz, 8.271 kHz, with radiated power, 10 milliwatts. So imagine, you have a Canada and you have a Germany, right? And then you have a 10 milliwatts, and then you have a quite successful communication on that frequency. Back to you, Dr. Roy, for your comment.
Okay, there are some people who are very fascinated by it, and as we mentioned repeatedly over the last few years, they kind of are called loafers, because of low frequency, and I always found that amusing because, you know, my last name is Laufer, and their nickname is Loafer, but unfortunately, you tend to do best when you have a lot of ground, because you could build much more efficient antennas that could express that frequency of RF out there. You live in a small, Brooklyn house, not a lot of space to put a nice long antenna out there. You can put a magnetic bar type of antenna like we used to have on our AM radios when we had transistor AM radios. But for them, great. I hope they enjoy it. I'm glad that the Navy gave it to them so that they could see what they could do with it. You know, the Navy has moved on to other technologies.
The interesting is that in Canada and Europe, there is a need for certification and licensing for that frequency. If I remember correctly, in the United States, everything lower 9 kilohertz is free for you to use. But of course, probably the limit applies. Dr. Ray?
I don't know the present status. At one point, 10 years ago, it was purely experimental. You had to apply to the FCC for an experimental call sign to operate on those frequencies. But since then, the Navy Department has really kind of let it loose. And so the FCC, as far as I'm aware, as long as you maintain specific limitations of power output, I don't know if you need to have necessarily an extra license. I never really saw that as a qualifier in any article I read, but it could be. I just don't know.
Yeah, I don't want to go to the specifics because we're going to start another topic. The low is the frequency, the low the power is required for the distance. But of course, there are, somebody might say, no, this is not true. So we're not going to that. We don't have the time for it. ICOM 7610 supports out at minus 14 dB on 630 meters band, and some amateurs have also modified IC735. So I was talking about IC7610, and they modified the IC735 transceivers for 630 meters transmission, achieving clean 100 watts transmission. Of course, there is a limitation on the power on that band with the power amplifier modification and low level preamp for better reception. And yes, you may be surprised that your radio in your car better is able to better receive 620 kilohertz frequency of your radio, AM radio, than your transceiver might be. Because it is focused, depends what technology that you offer. Back to you for the comments.
Okay, don't really have anything extra. I every so often I kind of dip my toe and I read a couple of articles on the subject. I don't have any particular expertise or experience or ability to do anything special or curiosity of what to do with it. It's there's other frequencies that I find more interesting personally, but each to their own.
The next one, what bothers physicists about black holes, interview with Brian Cox. We spoke about this subject a few times, but there is a particular moment in this video that has caught my attention. I would like to have your take on it. Paul wants to express his opinion, that would be great. What is the difference between singularity inside the black hole and singularity of the Big Bang? And then I sent you two quotes from the script. What is the relationship, we think, between the singularity and the center black hole and the point of the Big Bang? That was a very famous, very attractive woman that was asking for it. And actually, yes, it's an interesting time to spend, but what is your take on it? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, I like Brian Cox. Some science populists seem to be a little bit too taken with themselves, trying to always be profound, but I appreciate Brian Cox for what he said. He basically said that science doesn't really know much about either. So in the case of the fact that they don't know much about both of them, that the fact that they don't know anything about either of them is their similarity, which doesn't really get you very far, because there's a lot of things that kind of answer that way. People don't know what's at the center of a black hole. The laws of our present understanding of gravity break down. When you have point singularities or perceived point singularities really doesn't kind of mean anything. It's a flashing red light that says your science is gone. There'll be dragons past this point. And the same way about the Big Bang. You can go all the way back to the moment of the Big Bang, but you can't go beyond it, and you certainly can't go very far beyond it, because time itself is theorized to not have existed. So what does it mean to be 2 minutes behind a universe that's only 1 minute old? So that's all that he really said, that he doesn't know what the nature of either of those points are in the center of a black hole and the center of an exploding universe. That's about the closest it gets to what's similar about them. And we don't know much about them.
Intuition. If I understood you correctly, you're trying to say, like, let me put it in phrase. So, I don't know my best. So it depends on which type of black hole we consider. Here we consider a simple non-rotating black hole. We can't really say or think of a difference between the singularities other than the fact that one exists within the universe where the other was the universe part. This is irrelevant. So in both cases, the singularity was a single point where the curvature of space-time are finite. But then, it would fall within Hawking's theory if we think this way. Or could you just correct me? Back to you.
Again, they're not equivalent, especially one's going kind of in, the other's going out. So that kind of is another flashing red light that these are not equivalent things. If the center of a black hole was equivalent to the center of the Big Bang, then it should be banging. It shouldn't be sucking everything in. It should be throwing everything out. And if you go back to the history of black holes, there have been an endless stream of theoretical constructs of what we're calling that point is. There are some people at one point, I think that this theory has kind of died out, that there are white holes that are actually going in the opposite direction and that would be more like the Big Boom in that it's the mass is pouring out of it, although those are highly theoretical and dubious and no one has indicated any suggestion that there are things like white holes. There aren't even proofs for things like wormholes, although whenever you construct a theoretical wormhole, at some point it constricts down to a subatomic diameter where you couldn't get a quark through it. So white holes are kind of very theoretical. Wormholes are seemingly very theoretical. All we got really is the Big Bang and black holes. And other than a theoretical physical being broken and having a point source, they're significantly different. The one thing, like I said before, is they're going in the opposite direction time-wise.
Yeah, and here's the interesting point, because if we go according to Hawking, then you would say that the space-time were born from the Big Bang and there was no space-time before, and so the difference is that the space and time were born from the Big Bang singularity, and the black hole actually stretches out of space to the point where it probably weaves the fabric of space-time and ends time together. But that was Hawking. So I'm trying to get your take on it based on that what I said.
And I'd love to give you a Nobel Prize winning answer, exactly what's going on, and explain to you in minute detail how quantum gravity works. But no one has the faintest idea. The closest thing to a vague understanding of a very small special case for quantum gravity is the basis of Hawking's radiation, which he wrote in a brilliant paper and got great acclaim, and then made a bunch of money by BSing the subject and lying and telling people fairy tales in the popular books, because he felt that the people who read the popular books wouldn't understand the quantum gravity aspects. So he's got sort of feet of clay for Stephen, but, you know, what can I tell you? He had a tough life. So I don't know. I can't give you a simple solution to it. We really don't know the fundamental fabric going on behind the event horizon. There is nothing that I know of, that they know of, that they can pierce the event horizon. That is the escape velocity orbit of light and causality itself. So once it gets in there, for the most part, it was thought to never be able to get out. Now, because of Hawking's radiation, it's understood that all black holes have at heat. They have a thermal signature. They generate heat, and they dissipate energy through the dissipation of heat. The bigger the black hole, the lower its temperature. They're all black body radiators. So very, very small black holes, if they still existed, would evaporate relatively much quicker using Hawking's radiation. Massive black holes that we know today would take hundreds of billions of years to slowly evaporate away from thermal energy dissipation.
Thank you for that, Dr. Roy. I sent it to you, so... because we're going to take too much time if we ask the audience, so Paul, for your take. Paul, you wanna take your opinion on it, or you just pass it?
No, that's okay. But I do like Brian Cox. He's pretty good. I just saw him on an interview. I think he just came out with a new book. So that's why he was doing the interview. So I'll have to look into that. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, Klaus Herr, CEO on the rise of zero-click surges. It will be much harder to be a content creator, so we have a content creator in many areas. We have a YouTube, and we have a content creator, and the people who have a 5, 6, 7 million people, they make money on it, their bread. And they feel kind of safe. But there is a change because of AI in it, and it's a warning that, guys, you're going to have a much tougher life, and it's not two times, three times, or four times tougher life. So we're talking about time as 100%, 400%, many, many times. So we're talking about... clicks. I'm not sure if Dr. Roy was able till that time to open that email and eventually want to refer to that. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, this is a general thing. You know, you go to YouTube and you'll hear a lot of people complain and argue and yell and scream on both sides. You'll inevitably get the idiots who think that they're artists, because they could type into a art-generating AI, you know, draw me a clown with a red hat, and they draw him a clown with a red hat, and he says, see what an artist I am? I can draw a clown with a red hat. And there are other people who are trying to sell you on a class to teach you how to plug together a couple of AI modules together, and they'll generate their own YouTube videos. You know, there's one AI that will come up with a random topic. There's another one that will write a script. There's another one that will synthesize some random images. And there's another one that will synthesize a voice where they mispronounce common words like absolutely no human being ever did. And they could do it five times a day. So whereas it, you know, takes a person who's actually working hard on this, it could take them weeks, if not months, to produce a high-quality YouTube, these things just kind of print them off like counterfeit money, and they're all blithering crap. But if you don't know the subject, you're never quite sure if it is blithering crap. So a lot of people end up listening to it. I would love YouTube to have a imprint on the side someplace to tell me what's AI-generated and what isn't. Is it just voice synthesis? Is it image synthesis? Is it text synthesis? You know, what is it? And then be able to put filters on it so I don't have to hear the same exact voice narrating 10,000 random stories about something that I've seen other places just as well.
Okay, and to Xian. So I'm going to give you the quote, please, also talk about how the value exchange between Google and those who create web content is disappearing. You noted that almost a decade ago, every two pages, that Google scrapped the means that would send website a visitor. Today it takes six scrap pages to get one visitor, despite the crawl rate on changing. So it's going to be much harder for you to earn money if you are content creator, and probably that not only is limited to YouTube creators, but any other creators as well who wants to rely on it. So there is more competition in it. There is another subject, and that was sent to Dr. Roy and Paul. NASA wants three asteroids currently headed for the Earth. And, of course, it is very much scary. Let me drop. NASA is closely monitoring three asteroids making near-Earth approaches, but none pose a significant threat to Earth. Those asteroids, 2025, CF, CD, and CE, are being tracked for close pages. And that's the response from Dr. Roy. But that's what the articles from mass media and very much loud mass media, MSN and ABC and what other, it says you have a weak sky. So another NASA Center for Near Orbit study says detected three asteroids that are expected to approach the planet tomorrow, according to the data collected by the agencies, and killer asteroids could strike Earth within coming weeks. So guys, just sit down and relax on my new radio, because you're going to be killed eventually. Dr. Roy, for your comment.
It's just stupid clickbait. You don't get your scientific news from ABC. Don't get it. And most of the websites that you linked me to look at it, if you look at the bottom, look at the ads. Inevitably, it's ads for miracle toothpaste and all kinds of sham products. It's not a legitimate scientific journal. Yeah, get your stuff from the scientific journals, and you'll at least have a decent chance of not being screwed around with. But go to these other places that you go to, and it's guaranteed that it's the end of the world. The sky is falling. The sky is falling. Called Chicken Little.
Paul, your take on it?
I agree with that. Well, do you remember the Inquirer? Were you around in the 70s? When, we found life on Mars, and there's this weird crawling thing, or Hubble has taken a picture of heaven, you know? And that's what some of these websites remind me of, you know? We don't have the newspapers anymore, but, you know, the tabloids. But that's what that reminds me of.
But no, I didn't read that one, Wes, so I can't comment on the three asteroids that are going to wipe out Earth. Back to you.
Thank you very much. There were times that let SpaceX fly in the rain. So, of course, I've got the response from Dr. Roy, but this object is Roy's object. It's not my object. It's actually Roy's response that I would appreciate if he formulates. So, imagine that you have an insect that is smaller than the drop of water of rain, right? But they have a very clever mechanism that allows them to survive. And then I formulate a question that I can understand, but so that's the microscopic structure that works by creating protective barrier against raindrops, allowing insects to fly safely despite the falling water. But then, we're talking about classical physics. We have a drop of water at a certain speed, and heading into the dipset. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Okay, I don't particularly understand why the subject is so much me. It's a matter of biological engineering, of how you deal with water. Some insects are so small that they just kind of go right through the water droplet themselves. They don't really, their coating doesn't interact with the surface tension of the water, and so they just kind of go through it. Bigger insects that can't really use that trick use ultra hygroscopic surfaces that repel the water, and rather than have it hit on, it just kind of deflects it and rolls off the sides of its hygroscopic skin layer or wing layer and such. So it's kind of two different methods utilizing two different means of surviving these things.
Could you say a few words about super hydrophobic surfaces on the wings of those insects that repel water and keep them airborne bacteria? How could those insects fly during the rain bacteria?
Well, again, it depends upon their size and their method. If you structurally design the surface of a flying insect to not have much in the way of flat, straight surface area, if every bit of surface area is broken up with something else at a right angle to it, then the surface tension of the water drop itself is much more powerful and keeps the water together than interacting with the flies, with the insect's body. So it's a matter of structural engineering the surface layer so that it can get around and not compete with the surface pressures of the water droplets themselves and just kind of move them to the side.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Anybody has a comment? Because there's a no, then we go to the next one. What happens if you focus 5-watt laser with a giant magnifying glass? So we talk about negative cosmic chance. I mean, the title. So the title of the video is "What happens if you focus a 5-watt laser with a giant magnifying glass? Negative Kelvin temperature." That's the title. But then we talk about population inversion. And there was a quote on the video frame, if you had a chance to view that video. So in this video, I show you what it means to have negative temperature by focusing laser beam down to a single full point. I show you what happens if you try to focus a light down to a single point. Then I show you how a laser is different due to population inversion. And then, of course, if we try to take it broad, then we have to go why how the laser works and why you cannot have more light when you use the magnifying glass in front of your flashlight. But you could actually focus a laser and get it more powerful at the smaller point. Which actually reminds me of... Let me drop... Which actually reminds me of an example that I was using many times. If you push palm of your right hand or left hand with a finger from your right hand, yeah, you feel the pressure. But if you use the same pressure, if you use the same energy to push the needle, then the needle will actually go through your hand. So it is the area of where square root two. We know what we're talking about. Dr. Roy, your comment.
Okay, I don't know what you want to talk about, what you don't want to talk about. It's not, unfortunately, as simple as the surface area that you're exposing to whatever you're doing, the pressure or the needle or the hand or what have you. It's the annoying reality that temperature, which you learn in elementary school, I think, is the average kinetic energy, is not the average kinetic energy. Temperature is actually a function of entropy. And incandescent light sources or flashlights and the sun all have a positive temperature. Lasers, because of the nature of laser methodology, produces negative temperatures. And negative temperatures can be kind of collected and used to get an object far hotter than objects that output positive temperatures. And then you get into the problem trying to explain to people that negative temperatures are hotter than positive temperatures. You would kind of hope and think that a negative absolute temperature would be colder, because a non-absolute temperature that's negative is colder than positive ones. But in the case of absolute temperatures such as Kelvin, the more negative it is, it's very weird. It goes from temperature, let's say it starts at absolute Kelvin zero, you warm it up, it goes to infinity Kelvin, and then immediately it goes to minus infinity Kelvin, and when you heat it up even more, it goes to a lower negative number until you've gotten it as hot as it is possible to in this universe, and then it is minus 0 degree Kelvin. That's very difficult to wrap your head around, but that's the nature of what absolute temperatures are. That negative absolute temperatures are hotter than positive absolute temperatures.
I absolutely agree with you. But the video is interesting because the guy is trying to present without really big conclusions. He's just showing the typical things that people might be interested with. And he's quite successful. He's a content creator. Okay, so what happens if you focus 5 watt laser with the giant magnifying glass? That depends on the area. But then, should we go to a population inversion that, in my understanding, is a state of the system where more atoms and molecules are higher in higher excited energy state than in lower excited state. And this is a necessary condition for laser action, where the coherent light is emitted by stimulated emission. So should we concentrate in that in population inversion that cannot occur under the thermal equilibrium, where the lower energy states are always more populated bacteria?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate brain-hurting explanation. He just kind of shows you that it works. He doesn't necessarily demonstrate the underlying inversion that goes on in laser energy that sort of explains it. He just kind of said that it inverts it, so that's why it's able to get hotter than an incandescent light or the surface of the sun.
Okay, that would be all for today. Thank you very much, and to HG and Dr. Gray, back to you.
Okay, very good. Thank you as always, Wes. Interesting bunch of questions and comments and subjects and such. We all appreciate it. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is still the Limar Technical Net, and we're still kind of open for business. We got almost a half hour left before the SpaceNet generally usually begins. So if anyone out there would like to throw out a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, feel free. I don't think we're going to get much action from Echolink tonight. Echolink seems to not be connecting. Something's wonky going on there. Nevertheless, if you're out there and you got a question or a comment or a topic or something, feel free to hit that push to talk.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
So Wes didn't get to that one story dealing with the Relativity Rocket Company. I thought he was going to talk about that. That he set the YouTube on that. And that's a company that's, their goal was to 3D the whole rocket. So
you got to remember that. Wes, do you want to say a couple more words on the 3D printed rocket?
Yes, yes, yes. I have sent but I didn't open that link in my computer for this particular, but yes, there was one about 3D printed rocket kit. So actually, there was a video showing that the company decided, instead of just making components of the rocket, print the entire rocket. 3D printed the rocket, which we could see the analogy to parts of the rocket, the engines that are printed by Elon Musk, and then, but that's the domain of Paul. We had yesterday, there was another spacecraft. I don't want to talk too much about it because it's not my business. Okay, they just fly to go down, be there for a few minutes, collect the money from the rich guys who wants to be there. But anyhow, it's very interesting. Paul, please, go ahead, continue.
I copied what he said, but boy, did you hear the little vibration on the repeater? Is that happening with me? Was the repeater, or was that coming out of the link that Wes is going through?
You're fine. So I didn't hear it with you, and up until a minute or so ago, I didn't hear it with him. So I'm not quite sure what that was.
Actually, Dr. Roy, you're talking as normal, and then at the end it's something like a problem, but a little problem. But was my transmission received when I was talking about printed rockets, Dr. Roy?
Yes, you're fluctuating, and it's not
said, it's getting worse. It's getting worse.
Okay, let's see what happens. I think it's rebuilding the web page, so the connection is rebuilding, so I'm back again. Are you out there, Paul?
Okay, you sound great. Did you do something, or did it magically get fixed by itself?
Yeah, I love to take credit, but no, it just finally reset itself. Eventually, it notices that everything's gone, and it resets, and so
you made it through a half a sentence, and then it just quit. I'll stand by.
This is Brian KF 2CZ. Considering the problems, I'm going to be going QRT. Have a good night, everyone.
Okay, Brian. And you were very good. Your signal was excellent. So, I don't know. We'll stand by. Sometimes Roy loses all star, and then he comes back. So I'll stand by.
Okay, I hope I'm back.
Back, very well, very good. And it looks like we're losing Brian, but, you know, that's okay. What are you going to do? Maybe he'll stay with us if he hears us speaking. Yeah, I just wanted to comment about the Relativity Rocket. Relativity is the name of the company, and they started quite a few years ago. When they were starting out, they had a great idea of 3D printing their whole rocket, and they wrote a letter to Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban is one of these billionaire guys, and wondering if they would, you know, give him like, you know, $50,000 or something. I think he gave him 10 times that amount. He thought it was a great idea, and they have many other investors since. They completed a 3D printing of one of their rockets called the Charon 1. 80% of the rocket itself was 3D, made out of aluminum alloy, and they had one engine attached to it, and sure enough, they lit it off and a couple of years ago, and it took off. It was a liquid methane. I think it was the first liquid methane rocket to actually make, send the second stage to orbit. So it worked out very, very good. And that's that company, they changed their eventually because they wanted to build a big rocket called the Tehran R for reusability, and they did do that. They were in the process of it. They haven't gotten a chance to try sending it into orbit for, they think maybe next year, but it's a heavy lift vehicle, so they just the Tehran 1 pride rocket, because the first successful, and their main goal was to make this reusable rocket, and they plan on doing something similar to what SpaceX and Blue Origin are doing, just having these constant reusable rockets. And this is going to be a large rocket, very similar to the size, maybe a little smaller than the New Glenn, a lot bigger than what SpaceX is sending up, the Falcon 9, probably about twice the amount of thrust as the Falcon 9. If they can get this going, each engine is going to have around 260,000 pounds of thrust, 13 engines on the first stage. So we'll see how they do it. All liquid methane, by the way, and liquid oxygen. So we'll see how Relativity is the name of the company. They have a launch complex that they're building out down in Florida.
Very good. I'm looking forward to see how that works out. As most people hopefully know by now, I'm a big fan of 3D printing and even industrial commercial versions of it. So the more the merrier. I don't think these are particularly good times for aerospace engineering companies. I look forward to your comment that you'll make during the SpaceNet report about that poor guy, Jared Isaacman. I wonder what weekend talking head on Fox is going to run NASA now.
Okay, that's actually a big story. And on the 3D printing too. So they've pretty much gotten away from the 3D idea on the big rocket, although they're going to stick with the 3D certain components. But the overall size of the big rocket, they've gotten away from that idea. But they think that let's say when you get to the moon or whatever, they plan and on eventually sending equipment up there to maybe 3D other parts, maybe buildings and things like that. They're really into this 3D stuff. They have the world's largest 3D printing machine. We'll do that. Let me turn it back to you, Rogue. It's not even 10 o'clock. Back to you.
Okay, very good. Yeah, 3D printing is one of those promising technologies that experimenters first got into aggressively, and they wanted to kind of broaden it. And sure enough, if you go to places like Etsy, there's more than a few guys out there that subcontract their 3D printing. They have a design, and they order stuff. You order stuff from them on Etsy and such, and they send off the printing code to a manufacturer, and they kind of drop shift 3D printed stuff. And as time goes on, they use it a lot for dental procedures. They use it a lot for some metal prototyping. So it's one of those any day now type of fields that people are looking forward and hope that they take off. Even including building houses, I'm sure you've seen YouTube where they have this kind of clay-like product that oozes out of a tube, and they basically build walls for the entire house and then have it cure over time with some chemicals and such. So fascinating thing, 3D printing. I'm looking forward to the different types of...